Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books Network seminar. Welcome and thanks for joining us today. I just finished talking with Alex Galloway about his new book, La Ruelle, Against the Digital. This came out in 2014 with the University of Minnesota Press, and I was particularly interested in talking about it for the seminar because I think at its root, the kind of work that the book is doing really transcends individual disciplines. And it's really about kind of helping us to rethink, to think anew about and think anew with some basic fundamental concepts that are relevant really to a number of different disciplines, to a lot of kinds of work that are being done across the humanities, social sciences, and sciences right now. So what the book does is take the case study of the exploration of the work of a particular philosopher, this is La Ruelle, and it uses it to investigate the notion of the digital. And by digital, I don't just mean computers, I don't mean email or electronic, whatever. I mean the basic fundamental notion of distinction, of difference. And so at its root, this is a book that's exploring the notion of difference, the notion of identity, and in doing so, it's really giving us, I think, the tools to question our assumptions about some other really basic and very, very pervasive notions, like exchange, right? Like representation. I mean, like light and darkness. So there's some really, really fascinating stuff happening here that's asking us to really look at some of the notions that we take for granted in how we understand, write about, think about the world, and imagine what it might look like if we didn't take those for granted. What would the possibilities be in terms of ethics, in terms of politics, in terms of aesthetics, in terms of lots and lots of other kinds of things? So it's really fascinating. Alex takes us in really, really clear language and in a really, I think, very clearly laid out set of descriptions through the work of what might otherwise be a difficult set of ideas and a difficult kind of set of conversations. And it's really a pleasure to read. It's wonderfully clear. And it was a lot of fun to talk with Alex about it. And I think also it's a very important book. So I encourage you to get your hands on a copy and to explore the book. And thank you so much for listening to the conversation. I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Alexander Galloway about his new book, La Ruelle, Against the Digital. Welcome to the New Books Network seminar, Alex, and thanks very, very much for making time to talk with me today. I'm really looking forward to it.
So, hello. Yeah. Thank you.
So can you start us off by saying just a little bit about what brought you to the topic? How did you come not just to work on La Ruelle, but also to decide to write a book-length object about his work?
Well, I've been interested in critical theory and continental philosophy for a long time. And I'd been distracted by the internet, distracted by the internet, and I've been kind of an amateur coder since I was a kid, and had done a lot of work on digital media and trying to think critically about computing and software and digital media. But, you know, my training was really in critical theory and, French theory, French philosophy in particular. So I wanted to, after writing some works on new media, I wanted to kind of go back to that earlier set of interests and really try to write a more kind of straightforwardly theoretical or philosophically oriented book. And it just seemed like the right topic at the right time, you know.
My cat clearly thinks that's a fascinating story. Wants to hear more, so she's sitting here eagerly anticipating what comes next. Now, at several points in the book, you mention the term weird, right, to describe some of La Ruelle's work or his thought, and definitely this is a philosopher whose work hasn't been taken up much, at least in kind of mainstream cultural studies, mainstream philosophy. Were there any particular challenges because of that in sort of creating or getting support behind a project devoted to the work of a philosopher who hasn't quite, maybe a lot of people may not have heard about him, even though he comes across as really, really important in this book?
That's true. And that's a big issue. And, you know, I think weird is an adjective that comes up from time to time, in the context of Laruelle. And for me, it was a kind of friendly tip of the hat to, Anthony Paul Smith, who's also one of the people who's been working a lot in Laruelle, doing a lot of translation and writing his own, you know, work that is dealing with Laruelle at some level. And so he's talked about the idea of kind of the strangeness of the way Laruelle thinks. And the stranger is also a kind of term of art in Laruelle's own work. There's also maybe another thing we could talk about, which is an interest in the weird, if you will, almost in a kind of technical sense, right?
Sure.
So people are talking about, you know, whether it's H.P. Lovecraft and weird fiction or, and here I've been influenced a lot by my friend and sometimes collaborator Eugene Thacker and his work on horror. And, you know, so Laruelle, I think, has been picked up by people who are interested in, if you will, kind of weird ontologies. So ontologies that don't make much sense within a kind of standard, you know, philosophical lineage.
Mm-hmm. Great. And that definitely is something that we'll talk about over the course of the book. So in the preface, you mentioned that though Laruelle almost never talks about the digital, as you put it here, there's evidence of the topic on almost every page of his work. Mm. So that's a big, big, big theme, and we'll pretty much get right to that in a few minutes. Now, just to kind of situate the listeners who haven't had a chance to read the book within the text, among the other elements of the text provided in the 10 chapters to come, the intro and the conclusion, there are 14 numbered theses. So those are kind of sprinkled throughout the text and contextualized and also reiterated in a kind of abbreviated form at the end. So we'll occasionally touch on some of them along the way. Now, in the introduction called The Oldest Prejudice, you call philosophy the oldest prejudice and ask, is it possible to leave it behind? So in the introduction, you mentioned the chief aim of Laruelle's life's work is to consider philosophy without resorting to philosophy in order to do so, or put another way, to think philosophy unphilosophically. So this, I think, is a perfect place to start. Can you say a little bit about what non-philosophy is for Laruelle and his work, and what does it mean to do non-philosophy?
So this is kind of the central issue in Laruelle as you're making evident here. And what maybe I could even read this sort of outrageous quote that I have at the beginning of the book, because it's a great way to kind of open up the issue. So this is a quotation from maybe a lesser known small little piece that Laruelle wrote, and I love it. It goes like this: inebriated and bastardized by Plato, liquefied and cogitated into concentrate by Descartes, moralized by Kant, whipped by Sade, devoured by Hegel, disgorged by Stirner, conscripted by Husserl, chewed out by Nietzsche, down the wrong pipe of Derrida, turned over by Heidegger, crapped out by Deleuze, thrown up by Laruelle, and it would ask for more if we let it. So this is Laruelle's kind of, this kind of litany of kind of abuses, if you will, that philosophy has kind of, kind of unleashed on the world. And, you know, he's exaggerating here, of course, and poking fun and indicting himself in the list as well. But the, you know, the gist of it is that Laruelle views philosophy as a kind of almost a process. Well, there's a kind of soft theory of it and a hard theory of it. The soft theory of it is that philosophy is a process that is always about orientating oneself toward an object of reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have to be a philosopher, in other words, to be philosophical. You know, artists are philosophical, you can be philosophical in, you know, around the breakfast table. But then there's a kind of stronger theory of it, which is that because philosophy always requires an act of orientation, solicitation, direction toward some kind of object that it's reflecting on, it also has a tendency to kind of be domineering, or even worse, kind of harassing, right? So in other words, you know, I think it's somewhere else he basically says, like, you know, why doesn't philosophy just leave the world alone? You know, like, why is philosophy constantly badgering the world, right? Philosophy is the thing that always says that it has a rigorous way to deal with X, right? So you can have a philosophy of sport, and you can have a philosophy of gender, and you can have a philosophy of, you know, being rude or something. You know, everything under the sun is available for philosophical reflection. So this is the starting point that gets Larawell going, and he calls this the standard model. Mm-hmm. He says that this is the essence of the standard model of thinking and doing philosophy. And so so if this is, if you will, the oldest prejudice, what do you do, right? And I think there's sort of two basic things you can do. One is you can try to do a better job at reflecting on that history, on that process. Mm-hmm. And that better job, it might be more sensitive to the world, more sensitive to the objects of reflection, more tactful, right, more gentle or something. For this is, for Larawell, not a viable solution, because it essentially proposes a philosophical answer to a philosophical problem, right? So you are trying to kind of out-meta the world. And this is, you know, this is the essential, certainly in the modern era, this is the essential philosophical stance, right? So somebody like Kant, you know, defines the critical stance as the stance in which we are able to provide, you know, the kind of conditions of possibility for X, for knowledge, or for making judgments about the world. And so this is a kind of response that Larawell sees over and over and over and over again. So that's one avenue. The second avenue, which is the one that he takes, is not that the best problem to philosophy is to become a better you know, person who can do philosophy. The best response to philosophy is to stop doing it. And so this, for me, is very exciting, because it isn't an anti-intellectual stance. It isn't he's not trying to badger or berate people who, you know, dedicate their life to, you know, kind of intellectual pursuits. But he's saying there is a structure. Mm-hmm. There is a standard structure. And that's a standard structure that people either explicitly or implicitly decide to enact. And so his intervention is very simple. He says, you can decide not to enact that. You can withdraw from the decision, or what he calls the philosophical decision. And if you withdraw from that decision, then you discover this kind of, if you will, a kind of parallel universe. And that's what he calls the non-standard model. A synonym for that is non-philosophy.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And you just mentioned a term that comes up in your introduction as well, in terms of describing the two goals of the book, or at least two goals of the book, which is the term withdraw. So
yeah.
The two goals of the book, as laid out in the introduction, are, on the one hand, to define digitality and demonstrate its special connection with philosophy, and at the same time, to show that Larawell withdraws from the digital. Mm. So to kind of follow this through, let's move directly to this idea of the digital, right? Since this is completely crucial. Can you talk a little bit about that for listeners? I'll just kind of lob the ball back to you. What is the digital insofar as you're conceptualizing it here? And how is it contrasted with the analog? And what's important about that contrast?
First of all, I think we have to admit that the digital means a lot of different things. And there are a lot of books and articles and podcasts and TED Talks and a lot of resources that we could tap into, you know, if we want to try to define that word or explain what that concept means. And, you know, so in kind of wading through that material and incorporating it and, you know, sometimes maybe even participating in some of those conversations, I found myself kind of in a, at a kind of dead end. And what I mean by that is that there seemed to be a lot of people who were willing to provide a philosophy of the digital. In other words, they were willing to say, what is X? Okay, what is philosophy? What is digitality? Well, you know, we can make a laundry list about, you know, the formal qualities of web pages, or we could say, like, you know, what are the essential qualities that make a, let's say, a video game different from a 19th century realist novel? And there's, you know, fantastic work that's already out there. People like Lev Manovich who've worked in this area. So there was that body of work. And then there's another body of work, the so-called digital philosophers, the people not so much saying that we want a philosophy of the digital, but a digitization of philosophy, or a digitization of thinking, or even of the world. And this really runs the gamut from a whole series of either straight scientists. Sometimes they are mathematicians, people doing philosophy of science, or mathematicians who have put forward theories that essentially the world at its core is digital. Mm-hmm. Right? So some of these people end up being more or less atomists in the sense that they either, can provide empirical evidence for or otherwise are proposing that the world is fundamentally digital. So you have people in computer science working in the area of cellular automata and showing how, you know, like life itself can be modeled and out of basic cellular entities. So someone like Stephen Wolfram is probably the most visible person working in that area today. So that's kind of what I had in front of me. But even across all that work, it wasn't clear to me whether anyone had actually sufficiently explored what digitality itself is, right? And it seemed like that word had already come predefined for a lot of the people that I had run across. And I'm sure there's people I'm missing. But so I wanted to really just say, okay, so what is the digital? Let's see how far we can push that question. So is the digital about computers? Well, you know, that answer that question gets answered pretty quickly. If you say, well, the digital is about computation, well, you know, there's a lot of ways to do computation that doesn't, you know, require a computer. There are analog computers, et cetera. So then what is the digital, in fact? Is it about zeros and ones? Well, maybe, we can swap in other tokens in there. It doesn't have to be a zero. It doesn't have to be a one. So maybe the digital actually is just about a kind of fundamental ability to make a distinction between something and something else. Now, binary, you know, base two mathematics, zero and one dot mathematics is a very effective way of doing that. But I think that there's maybe even something that comes before that base two mathematics that still needs to be explained. So with that in mind, I, you know, put forward a kind of hypothesis that the digital means, and this is what's given in the book, that the digital means whenever you have the one dividing into the two, you have a process of digitality. The one dividing into two. And then the pair hypothesis that goes with that is that the analog or analogicity means the two coming together as one. So that's the kind of hypothesis that fuels the exploration into the digital in the book. And the reason why I feel that I can talk about digitality in a book that is really about theory and philosophy is that Well, you know, the one is probably the oldest single topic in Western philosophy. It's in Parmenides, right? It's in Plato. It reoccurs in any number of thinkers. And it's certainly alive and well in contemporary philosophy, particularly French philosophy. The one is something that has a very important role to play in the work of Gilles Deleuze. Mm-hmm. It has a huge role to play in the work of Alain Badiou, who I would say is probably the single most influential French thinker working today. And then it has really a kind of marquee status in the work of Laruelle. It's probably the single central theoretical issue that he's dealing with. So given that the one was so is and was so prevalent in the history of philosophy, I felt like it was just kind of too tantalizing not to say, well, you know, we have digitality, which is all about ones and twos, or zeros and ones, but really ones and twos. And then you have philosophy, which since its very founding has had to wrestle with the question of the one, the other, the one, the multitude, the one, the many.
That's right. I mean, I think these basic issues of distinction and identity.
Yeah.
I mean, these are fundamental, and these are, I think this is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons that I was really looking forward to talking about the book and that I really appreciated the book, because you don't have to be a philosopher, right? I mean, in any number of fields of the arts and sciences right now, these problems of basically at their root, distinction and identity.
Yeah.
You know, they really animate so much of what so many of us in so many fields, right, across the arts and sciences are concerned with right now. So having a language to begin to talk about that, that's not disciplinarily rooted, is actually really useful.
Yeah. No, I think you're right that you know, this is a book about Laruelle and digitality, but it's actually really a book about, as you say, distinction and identity, or even we could say difference and identity. You know, difference has been a super important theoretical problematic for a long time, and so that's also something that reemerges in this project as well.
That's right. So as we move into the book, we move from a definition that you just elaborated a little bit on of the analog, the two coming together as one, to kind of explore some more characteristics of the one, right, as we kind of move forward into the rest of the book. And in the first chapter, which is part of the first part of the book, Laruelle and the Digital, you talk about the one in terms of the real and in terms of imminence. So because this idea of imminence is actually really important, I think, to what comes next, can you talk a little bit about the kind of work that imminence is doing here? What's important for us to understand about imminence in order to understand the larger work that the book is doing?
Well, first let me say, you know, let me acknowledge something that's really important here, which is that, you know, the one has a bad reputation. Let's be clear about this. you know, particularly if, you know, I was reared essentially on critical theory and feminism and, you know, Marxism and cultural studies and identity politics. And, you know, I kind of come out of that tradition. And in that tradition, the one has a really bad reputation. And the reason is, you know, the one is considered to be, you know, on the side of essence, on the side of a kind of, let's call it a kind of, you know, naive sense of unity, the tendency to, let's say, privilege the self rather than the other, or unity rather than alterity or difference or something like that. So I fully acknowledge that this is a potentially controversial, or maybe even, I don't know, might really turn people off. For me, and to go back to, you know, some of the opening issues about why I'm motivated to get to this material, is that I feel like we're at a real important turning point now in sort of, you know, how people think about the world and the capacities of criticism, and whether criticism is even something we can do anymore. And for me, we've hit a kind of wall, which is that, you know, we really live in a world where, you know, that is rooted in the concepts of multiplicity, difference. You know, the computer is a difference engine. You know, I mean, that's what it is. And so I feel like that the kinds of methodological approaches that have so fueled critical theory for a generation are not things we have to throw out by any means. But I do think that they're kind of, this kind of juggernaut is now, I don't know, maybe slowing down a little bit. And we need to, you know, really kind of rethink a lot of these essential questions. So I guess for me, the Holy Grail is really to try to see if some of these basic terms that, let's say, postmodern theory had definitively thrown out, right? Maybe there's something useful that we can exhume from some of these previously buried terms. So, you know, Alain Badiou, for example, has famously brought truth back, you know, as something that people can talk about again, the thing that postmodernism thought it had definitively destroyed. And so maybe somebody like Laruelle is allowing us to bring back the concept of, if not maybe the one, then a concept of identity. I think there's a lot of kinship here with the notion of the common or commonality that is a big deal in a lot of other people's work, or a term that I know we're going to probably want to get to soon here, a term that Laruelle uses a lot, which is the generic.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a kind of kinship or resonance established between a series of terms there that kind of come together around the one. So for me, you know, if you asked about immanence, and part of the oldest prejudice of philosophy, I think, is that, and you know, philosophers, I'm sure, will disagree with me on this point, but I think it's defendable, which is that for me, philosophy always tends toward having a transcendental relationship to the world. In other words, philosophy is kind of on the side of the transcendental. Now, I oppose to that, and as a kind of alternative to that, is the concept of immanence. And so I define immanence in a very straightforward way, which is that immanence is the condition of remaining within, right? When something remains within itself, when it does not have to go outside of itself in order to realize itself, that's the condition of immanence. So immanence is something that I think we can differentiate from, again, a more standard, if you will, standard philosophical or metaphysical model in which things, in order to realize themselves, have to go outside of themselves. Right? So, you know, God has to give his only begotten son, right? I mean, there are theological tinges to this that we could describe, or even in a more kind of strictly secular sense, dealing with ontology, you know, essence has to kind of outer itself or go outside of itself and instantiate itself into things in the world. Or if you want to go from the perspective of mankind or from the perspective of the mundane, you could say things in the world, in order to realize themselves, must, you know, I don't know, fulfill their teleological arc or something. Or, this is the language in which metaphysics speaks. So that's what I mean when I say that standard tradition of philosophy tends toward the transcendental. Immanence is the state when you don't have to go outside of yourself in order to realize yourself. And so I think that the one and immanence basically go together. They're more or less the same thing.
Great. Thank you so much. And this is a really nice place, I think, from which to move on. So You talk about in this early part of the book, in the first part of the book, a number of concepts and terms with which we can kind of build out from Laruelle's work to understand what he's doing and to understand the stakes and how to kind of do non-philosophy in this way or what that might look like. So I'm not going to ask you to talk about the details so that we have time to get to some of the really super cool stuff on, you know, the aesthetics and et cetera at the end, but I'll just mention for listeners that there's some really interesting work here on the idea of the prevent. Is that, am I pronouncing that right?
Prevent? Sure. Yeah. I mean, I made it up.
Oh, you made that up. Okay. So let's, so there's this, let's kind of use this as a way to segue into the kind of what's happening, next. So there is, you made up this notion. I'm really glad to hear that because that's exciting. This notion of the prevent. Okay. This is something that's really crucial to what's going on early in the book, and it's also something that we can kind of treat in contradistinction to or in relation with the notion of the event, right, which comes up later. So as a way to kind of move from here to what comes later, can you talk about, and also because you made up this concept, so let's mark that and celebrate that. Let's talk a little bit about the prevent. What do we need to understand about the prevent and its relationship or not to the idea of an event in or to understand what you're doing with digitality and Laruelle here, and what's important about this notion of the event as it animates Laruelle's work?
Yeah, so, you know, so in reading up on Laruelle and trying to, you know, sort out, it's tough going a lot of the time and trying to sort out, well, you know, what's his basic theory of, you know, how does he wrangle ontology? You know, what's his stance on the ethical? What's his stance on the political? What's his stance on art and so on? The event is a kind of age old topic for theorists and philosophers to contemplate. And so the notion of the prevent is really a way to, and it comes directly from he has some important essays. Some of them are actually the earliest ones that were translated into English. One of them is about Laruelle's theory of the event. And so he kind of puts forward this notion that, that there's always a kind of positivity or productivity or generative capacity that's always been embedded in the concept of the event. And what I love about Laruelle is that he wants to say, well, that's great, but why can't we also have a concept of the of an event that is about undoing and unmaking? But do it without cheating, right? In other words, don't just say, well, when you undo, you're still doing an event, but it's an event in reverse or something, right? He means, no, literally, stop eventing. Stop making events. Stop doing events. Stop eventing. It's very similar to what we said at the top about the philosophical decision and realizing that you can decide not to. Which again isn't a new decision, right? It's not a meta decision that comes after the philosophical decision. It's simply an abstention, if you will. And so I think that the prevent opens up a space to think about a form of event that is an undoing. So the prevent is a kind of it's a kind of play on words that is meant to encapsulate both prevent as prevention. So kind of preventing something from happening, right? Like if you don't want the harassment of metaphysical hierarchies, what do? Well, you can fight them or you can undo them, right? And so prevention, I think, is part of that. But then there's also another aspect, hopefully embedded in this word, which has to do with pre-event, meaning the thing that comes before the event.
Awesome. And so this becomes really, really interesting and kind of around the fourth chapter of the book, when you take us into this idea of, okay, well, you know, event has often been understood as a kind of relation or as a decision.
Yeah.
So how do we understand what an event is and how an event is in a context where kind of the point is to withdraw from that decision, right? So how do we get our heads around that? And there's a whole chapter that I think really, really nicely goes into that and sort of conceptualizes the event as a prevent.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the event is a big topic of discussion these days, and I'm not claiming to have the last word on it. You know, I think Zizek just published a new book on the event that a lot of people are reading. And the event is a central issue in the work of Alan Dideau. So in that chapter, I wanted to describe what I see as two kind of prevalent ways of thinking about events today, and then using Badiou and Deleuze, Alain Badiou and Gilles Deleuze, as kind of ready examples of the two positions. And one has to do with the event as a decision. And so this is a kind of, I think this is a pretty common way of thinking about an event, right? Like you want something to change, and so you enact a kind of, you know, you kind of enact or precipitate that change, and so the event then becomes a kind of decision point or a point of articulation, right? A curve or a veering in the course of events. But then the second one has to do with relation, and this is, I think, slightly different. But what it means is that, you know, the difference between any two things or any two states of affairs is simply the series of things or events that you would have to enact in order to translate one configuration into another configuration. Mm-hmm. Right? In other words, an event is just the kind of relation between now and the future, or the past and now, or something. So this is it has much more currency, I think, actually, in computation and in the cybernetic legacy, right? Dealing with states, state changes. So anyway, that's a kind of summary of the chapter on the event. And then I wanted to introduce Laruelle's notion of the prevent as really what I see as a kind of, an alternative that you really don't see in the existing conversations about the event.
Great, thank you. So this actually brings us, I think, nicely into the second part of the book. You mentioned the importance of Deleuze, and this is something that very much is at the heart of Chapter 5. So part 2 of the book, Withdrawing from the Standard Model, explores computers and capitalism, among other things, which, as you put it here, are two important aspects of digitality as it actually exists, right? Mm. As a way to, as you put it, outline some of the necessary conditions for withdrawing from the standard model of philosophy. So what kinds of conditions might, you know, make it possible to do what we've just read about the possibility of doing in the first part? So chapter 5 takes on computers, and it considers, among other things, the work of Deleuze as a way to understand Laruelle. Now, one of the really interesting things that you're doing here is talking about the idea of a control society, the politics and aesthetics of a control society in the work of Laruelle and Deleuze. So could you talk a little bit about that? What's important about that notion in order for us to, or for us to understand, in order for us to understand more broadly what the work that you're doing in this second part of the book?
So that chapter is it's a kind of intermission. There's a lot going on in this book, and I wanted to give the reader a chance to kind of pause a little bit in the middle and have a kind of break. Mm-hmm. I kind of try to have fun with these things, and the table of contents and the organization of the book also has a kind of like binary structure to it, to the extent that you can pull that off. And mm-hmm. You know, I really wanted the book to have 10 chapters, 10 chapters, and the people who understand binary will get the joke. So in the middle, I wanted to really kind of deal with computation, maybe not again, like not in terms of binary numbers or zeros and ones, but to think about this, you know, this concept that emerges really in the late Deleuze, the concept of the society of control. And so that chapter is really about, it's really about, well, I don't know, there's a few things going on, but it's really about kind of periodizing Deleuze and trying to put Deleuze's reception, particularly in the English-speaking world, let's say over the last 10 or 15 years, in a larger context. And to make an argument for maybe a more political or if you will, sustaining what was always a very political aspect of Deleuze's work. I think the biggest thing that's happened to Deleuze in the last decade or 15 years is that he's become essentially either an apolitical thinker in a lot of people's minds or has become a kind of unwitting reactionary figure these days. So part of that chapter has to do with trying to reclaim a much more politicized Deleuze. And, you know, he's very old when he writes this essay called Postscript on Control Societies. It's at the very end of his life. He had health problems. And I think that, you know, like I say in the chapter, I think that, you know, maybe at a certain point, this will become really a canonical essay that will be kind of a classic essay that really defines his entire body of work, which it really hasn't been until maybe, you know, more recently. So that's part of what I'm trying to do in that. It's to really recapture a skepticism or even a kind of pessimism that is evident at this late stage in his life, where he's looking at, you know, the advanced industrial society around him, and you know, he's really worried about it.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. And now there's another chapter that I would love to talk with you about for an hour, but we have to get to the aesthetic stuff, so we won't. I'll just mark and mention for listeners, there's an entire chapter 6 on capitalism, which is fascinating. It talks about Lauerweil's particular kind of Marxism, right? You say he's a Marxist, but he's a Marxist in kind of an unusual way. So far as he's got this critique of capitalism that denies exchange.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we should just talk a little bit about that, because this idea of, and then we'll get to the aesthetics. So this idea of exchange is so important here. Can you say just a little bit about that? Sort of what's important about this in terms of the larger work that the book is doing?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that really has sustained my interest in Lauerweil is that he, you know, how can we put it? He kind of breaks all of these rules, and, you know, like all of the things that you're taught, you know, if you study, you know, I don't know, theory or something, he really kind of breaks a lot of the expected. He deviates from a lot of the expected stances on things. And so part of the fun of reading him is almost kind of, you know, daring yourself to reevaluate maybe some of the orthodoxies that you've internalized or that I've internalized. So like I said earlier, you know, having to do with the one me, you know, it took me a long time to really come around and see that that's a concept that shouldn't just be dismissed. So the chapter on capitalism and on Marxism was born in out of very simple circumstances, which is that Lauerweil wrote a book on Marx, which has recently been translated into English. You know, he, I can just even say as an aside, one of the things that is most, I think, useful about Lauerweil and at the same time maybe something that aggravates people is that he's really the inventor of a method. And anyone who invents a method, if it works well enough, it becomes a kind of, you know, like Swiss Army knife that they just bring out and brandish in every circumstance. And that's kind of what Lauerweil does, right? So his method is so useful and so effective that he can bring it out and do a non-philosophy version of anything, right? So he can, there can be a non-Marx and there can be a non-Badiou and there can be a non-Derrida and a non-Deleuze. So he does that with Marx. And what comes out of it is that, you know, we haven't really gotten to this aspect of the one, but one of the things that is entailed in the withdrawal from philosophy and this exploration, the exploration of this standard model, is that the typical way of thinking about relations, relations between things, and a kind of sister concept, which is causality, those, the typical way that those things are talked about has to kind of go away. Mm-hmm. Right? Because the one can't have any relationship to anything. Otherwise, it's not the one, right? Mm-hmm. And so Lardwell ends up inventing a parallel set of, I won't really call them relations or relational structures, because that would be misleading, but he comes up with a parallel set of things that kind of take the place of what would be relational or relationship concepts in other people's thinking. And what I love is that the most important one for him, he actually gets from Marx. And he actually gets it from the way in which Marx was read in the French tradition, particularly through the work of Louis Althusser, who, as you know, is, you know, one of the single most influential Marxist thinkers, particularly for a kind of more rigorous mode of Marxist theory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Althusser has, you know, suffered many deaths over the years. And interestingly, today is Lardwell is one of the people who's really trying to bring him back, or bring back a certain Althusserian interpretation of Marx. And so the concept that is at the root of all this is the concept of determination. Determination. So determination becomes, you know, it doesn't replace the concept of relation or exchange, but as I said, it sort of does, it's a kind of cognate, it has a kind of cognate function or something for Lardwell that relation or exchange might have in other thinkers. So I know I'm kind of beating around the bush, and the chapter really isn't about, you know, I don't know, the labor movement or, you know, like revolution or, you know, Bolshevism or something. That's not really what the chapter is about, but it's about, you know, the notion, well, maybe exchange is actually the most violent thing that capitalism does.
Mm-hmm. And that's right? Like, that's a hugely important point.
Yeah.
Right. That's like a, whoa, hold on, stop everything. Yeah. What do you do? This is another way I think where the book is really profound in speaking to a wide range of kinds of ideas and practices right now that like assume exchange and the importance of exchange, even without realizing that we're doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think part of the reason is that, you know, it's not like nobody has looked at this. I mean, mm-hmm. But I think part of the reason is that post-structuralism and that, and actually just semiotics and, you know, that kind of linguistic turn in general, really had to retain a concept of exchange. That was not something that could be thrown out at that moment, right? Because, you know, if you're doing semiotics or you're doing post-structuralism, you have to have a notion of the kind of circulation of signs, right? So it really comes out, it comes directly out of, you know, maybe Freud, but certainly a Marxist tradition of looking at economic systems, circulation, accumulation, exchange. So I think that that legacy was so closely connected and wedded to the concept of exchange that it couldn't conceive of a theoretical stance that did away with that.
That's right. And it's like so much right now of the humanities is going toward or is already firmly moving in the direction of, you know, studies of circulation and movement and economy, et cetera. It's going to be, I think, a really, really interesting conversation to have is to get a bunch of like global historians or historians of like commodities into a room together, read this chapter or read the book and sort of have a conversation about what the potential impacts might be. So maybe we'll do that.
They would probably
maybe
hate
we'll
it.
Maybe not. So there's a couple more things that I want to make sure we have a chance to talk a little bit about, although we could keep talking about, you know, this idea of exchange and his engagement with Marx. I want to talk a little bit about aesthetics. Aesthetics is a recurring theme in Laruelle's work, and there's at least a couple of chapters that deal directly with this. We won't talk about the Black universe in any depth, although there is a really wonderful chapter, chapter 7, that looks at and explores notions of Blackness and light, kinds of darkness, and the ways that these inform and are informed by Laruelle's work and the idea of the digital more broadly. And then there's a chapter, chapter 8, that looks at art and utopia and is one of my favorite parts of the book, in part because I'm speaking of nons, right? Non-Marx, non-X. You're looking at the possibility of a non-representational aesthetics in this chapter, which is itself a really interesting idea. Non-representational aesthetics, like what would that look like? What could that look like? And doing it through an examination of the work of a super duper cool Hungarian artist, August von Briesen. So can you maybe talk a little bit about that? What would it mean to have or to think with a non-representational aesthetics? And how does the work of this super duper cool Hungarian artist help get us to thinking in those terms?
That's the chapter I wrote. That's the last chapter I wrote for the manuscript. And I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff that got poured into that chapter. And it's actually one of the chapters that I'm most proud of, not so much because of what was produced, but because of the process that went into doing it. It's the most archival, in fact, of all the chapters. And I got started on it because of a favor, one of Laruelle's former students, the gallerist Miguel Abreu, happened to have a banker's box in his apartment filled with old Xeroxes and unpublished notes and manuscripts from Laruelle. And a lot of them have to do with his work on art. Some of them were published in French in some very obscure places. And so I could track them down by other means, but it was just nice to get this kind of trove of documents. And so I really wanted to try to filter through all that stuff and, not give the definitive essay on Laruelle's aesthetics, but really, you know, provide a lot of maybe even new material that other people working on Laruelle hadn't had a chance to get to yet. And one of the moments that was a real revelation for me was when I ran across an essay that Laruelle had written on this artist that you mentioned, August von Briesen. And so I was, you know, thinking, wow, this is interesting because one of the things that Laruelle does is he almost never talks about, he never acknowledges who his influences are. and he's very cagey in that way. And he also will never kind of cede to other philosophers and sort of acknowledge, you know, that they have a legitimate stance or something, right? And so the few moments when he does that, your eyes really light up. So he will mention Michel Henry in a positive light, right? And he will from time to time mention certain other people in a positive light. And those are moments that really kind of stand out. And so to see that he had actually written on a real artist was exciting for me. He also wrote a piece on James Turrell, the artist who uses light and space in very interesting ways. And so that also is in the chapter. And so this guy, August von Briesen, was a real mystery, trying to track him down. He was an expatriate who eventually settled in Paris. You know, a very eccentric person, who would, he was a devotee of the concert hall, and he would, go to, concerts, habitually, and bring his pencil and paper, and he would sit in the orchestra pit, not in the auditorium proper, but he would sit in the orchestra pit, and then furiously he would draw music.
Right.
And so then this, and the works that are produced are really spectacular. They almost kind of, I think the closest connection would be something like Kandinsky's work. And you know, his work is also very musical, trying to capture, in Kandinsky's terms, trying to kind of capture the level of spirit, the spiritual. And so, you know, I was exploring this, and then it turns out that Michel Henry had written on this artist. Very interesting. It turned out that a few other, notable French figures had written on this guy. So that was what kind of fueled my exploration into this. And I finally got a copy of the manuscript, you know. I think Larouel said he didn't even have a copy of it, but it was in the Bibliothèque Nationale. And so it took me months to get a mimeograph of this thing. Anyway, so that's how that chapter was born. I ended up finally getting in touch with, the daughter of that artist. And it turns out he had just kind of created, he had created this fantasy world, right? He invented his own quote unquote foundation that had a fancy, name. It was named after a kind of it had a European kind of aristocratic sounding name. And so he was really a kind of, in a sense, a kind of huckster or, a master of self-promotion, right? So he published his own beautiful catalog essays, his own beautiful catalog where he got these, you know, philosophical luminaries to write for it. But it really was his own imprint, right? So anyway, that was like kind of the more fun archival stuff that went into writing that chapter on Larouel's theory of art.
Great. Thank you so much. And you you take us into using this example, the kind of idea of an aesthetics of the immanent, right? So the immanence from the very beginning of our conversation, rather than an aesthetics of the transcendental. So this is something that we're going to get to the generic. We're going to get there. I'll just mention this without asking you to go into too much detail. But for listeners who are particularly interested in the kind of aesthetic consequences of thinking the immanent rather than thinking the transcendental, this is a really, really nice chapter to explore to do that. Okay, so the generic, Alex, this is something that came up at the beginning. It's the last body chapter of the book, and so I've saved it to the end. What is the generic? What's the big deal about this, and what do we need to understand about the idea of the generic to understand the kind of to understand the work that you're doing here in the book, but also to understand perhaps the larger stakes of this project.
The generic comes out of, again, one of these sort of age-old problems in Western philosophy, which is the relationship between the particular and the universal. The particular and the universal. So, and, you know, philosophers love to do this. They always say, like, well, you know, consider this desk, right? Or consider this tree. You know, how do I know that this tree is the same tree today that it was, than it was yesterday when I sat under it contemplating the meaning of life? In other words, how does this particular tree have a relationship with, let's say, I don't know, the universal category of tree, or in the metaphysical tradition, some kind of essential tree? So Larouel, along with a number of other people who we could also talk about, think that, you know, more or less think that that conversation is a bunch of hooey and really just not worth pursuing anymore. And so the generic is a way to more or less throw out this death match between the particular and the universal and replace it with an alternative that doesn't lapse into this kind of back and forth, you know, never ending conversation about, well, is it the particular, is it the universal? And so the generic, the way to think about the generic is I think you can think about it along similar lines to what we said at the top about withdrawing and opting not to decide in favor of the philosophical. So people like Giorgio Agamben, even Hardin Negri, people like Alain Badiou have experimented with the logic of sort of subtraction is maybe one way we could put it. And what do I mean by a logic of subtraction? Well, there's the notion of you know, what is a person? What is a thing, if not the accumulation of the qualities of that thing, the experiences that that person you know, kind of accrues throughout the course of his or her life. And so it's a kind of a model of accumulation or adding qualities or experiences to things. And the subtractive model is one that says, well, what if you start to erase all of those predicates? What if you say that something is not the sum of all of its experiences, qualities, adjectives, epithets, the things that, that describe it, you know, the terms that describe the qualities of things. And so if you erase those predicates, you know, Agamben has this lovely way of putting it. He says, you get to the whatever. So he says, you have the thing, whatever it is.
I can I can get behind a philosophy of the whatever.
Love that.
Okay, sorry, go on.
Yeah, and actually an interesting young French theorist, Tristan Garcia, has a nice play on words where he uses this colloquial French term, n'importe quoi, and it's been translated into English as whatever. And I don't know, I think there's a lot to that. I make connections too with the common in the work of Hardin Negri and others. So the generic is that, you know, it's the person whatsoever he or she is, but it's different from the particular, right? It's not the particular in that sense, and of course, it's not the universal. It's not some kind of, you know, we have not now graduated into the universal subject. You know, this is not a kind of, a kind of classic liberal model of a kind of individual who has been set free from all the particularities of his or her culture and history and become a kind of abstract person or a kind of transcendental person. And that's, I think, a huge misconception that often comes up in discussions of the generic. I think the generic is totally different. It has nothing to do with that. The generic is not about removing yourself from the particularities of culture and history. It's, in fact, counterintuitively, I grant you, but it's, in fact, the most fully embedded state, I think, vis-a-vis the normal material conditions of life.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for taking us through some of the highlights in what I think is a really exciting book that I think, you know, again, like I've said, has potentially very wide ramifications if we kind of turn our attention to it. So there's a ton of material in here that we haven't had a chance to talk about. There are entire chapters, right, on politics and ethics and victimhood and darkness and light that we haven't talked about and haven't had time to in this hour. Granted, and given that, is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about but that you'd like to mention for listeners? And if so, perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had a chance to become readers.
Well, the you know, the book does have an arc to it, And the place where the book ends is what we just talked about, the concept of the generic. But the larger background there is really trying to think about the status of politics and ethics today. So I think one thing that Laura Willett participates in, maybe not even consciously, I'm not sure, is what we could call a kind of ethical turn in contemporary thinking. Meaning that I think that there is, and I make a very clear distinction between the political and the ethical. And I don't think there's a single political word in all of Laura Well, but I think everything in Laura Well pertains to the ethical. So that's also something, again, I don't think we'll have time to go into it, but that's maybe something I could flag for potential readers if they're interested in the ethical turn and what it means today. And I'm of two minds of this. You know, I mean, I'm a Marxist and I have a great interest and investment in the political. So I don't think that Laura Well offers everything, but he certainly offers a extremely rigorous and interesting theory of the ethical.
So now that the book is out, and congratulations on what I think is a really exciting book, what's next for you? What are you working on now, and what's currently inspiring you?
I'm going to try to do as little as possible. I think I'm going to take a break. I think I'm going to take a break from any kind of big, ambitious project. Mm-hmm. There are certainly some themes and topics that really interest me. I've been doing some more coding recently, teaching coding to undergraduates right now, which is really fun. Mm-hmm. Thematically, I'm interested in some of the things that did come up in the book that maybe weren't entirely explored. So you mentioned the concept of night or darkness. I've become fascinated with the notion of obfuscation, mm-hmm. and opacity, which I think has a huge, is just hugely influential and interesting in where theory is going today. Mm-hmm. So that's maybe something that I would want to work on in the future.
That's really cool. I just along those lines, I just talked with someone who's working on complet in Chinese literature specifically, who's making a similar argument for the importance of fog and smog and sort of this as a way forward. So I would go to that conference.
Fantastic.
I would go to that conference. So Alex, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure. Congratulations on a fantastic book, and thanks very, very much.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to have, a conversation with someone who's read it and has such a, informed position on it. So thank you.
You've been listening to the New Books Network Seminar. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.